Good afternoon. It is 10 minutes after 1. And the House Judiciary Committee has a quorum with which to conduct business. In attendance are Representative Samuels, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Rammers, Representative Coghill. We have three bills before us today, and we're going to take them up in this order. House Bill 414, an act relating to the Crime Victims Compensation Fund, which is a Judiciary Committee bill, and we thank Representative Samuels for forwarding that so that the committee could consider it. Secondly, we're going to take up House Bill 355, initiative bill. And then dual sentencing is the third piece of legislation that we will get today. Our friend Representative Johansson is in the room, growing his beard as we speak, and we thank him for joining the committee. Perhaps that'll be fully grown by the time that we get done with the Victims Crime Compensation Fund. We're going to take up HB 414, and now I see why we're doing. Now I get it. I didn't. Welcome. I'm so happy to see you.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Rammers and aide to the House Judiciary Committee. And before us today, we have House Bill 414, an act relating to the Crime Victims Compensation Fund. The Crime Victims Compensation Board was established into law under AS 1867 in 1972 to help mitigate the financial hardships innocent victims suffer as a direct result of violent crime. The board may compensate medical expenses, counseling costs, lost income, lost support, funeral expenses, and other reasonable costs sustained by Alaskan victims of violent crime. The Victims Crimes Compensation Board awards approximately 85% of its budget directly to the victims and or their service providers. The average amount the board awards annually is $1,345,338. What this bill would do is create a non-general fund program definition, the 83rd one, for the Violent Crimes Compensation Board under AS 3705-146C. Revenues could be placed directly into this fund, and the feds would match the money in this fund at 60 cents to every state dollar, therefore giving the board more money without costing the state additional funds. Available revenues that are set forth in statute for this fund come from inmate salaries, restitution payments, permanent fund dividends, and payments made to the Victims Crimes Compensation Board under repayment agreements. However, these funds are currently placed into the general fund and returned to the general fund if not used at the end of the year. This would keep a fund where the money was in there and the feds could actually match at 60 cents for a dollar. And that's basically what this does. And Gerald Godfrey is online to answer any questions, and he is chair of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board.
Jane, thank you very much for that presentation. The committee recognizes Representative Holmes and Representative Grunberg. It's a pleasure to have you here. And we think it's Jared Godfrey, I think.
Jared.
I was visited by this this committee, and as were, I suspect, other members, and I have the same reservations about all these little pots of money floating around in the building and the concern that that causes. In this particular case, having been a victim of property crime myself this weekend, with one of our brand new TVs was stolen right out of the hotel. It wasn't even 10 days old. I mean, there's just no end to what people will do. But fortunately, you know, we can afford it, but many of the crime victims that we see, property and violent crime victims that we see, are not so fortunate. And so I thought it was quite appropriate for the Judiciary Committee to take this up and at least to kind of give it a good push and a head start to see if we could put ourselves in a position to be able to apply for federal funds and to have more money to distribute, because God knows there's no shortage of victims in the state of Alaska. And are there any questions for the Judiciary Committee, or Jane is the bill sponsor?
A statement.
Representative Bilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to make a statement. Every year as legislators, we get many copies of reports that have information that's been assimilated and put together for our use. And I have to honestly tell you that the Victims Compensation Board is probably the only report that I have read every single word of at least twice. And the reason for that was, the first time was going through writing down questions. The second time was to get a greater understanding. And I just think for the work that they do, it's incredible, and the effect and the things that they do that impact other people's lives. Luckily, probably most of us at this table and in this room are not impacted and have not been impacted by the violent crimes that many of these folks at this board deals with, and I'm grateful for that. But I totally support 100% us having the system in place and allowing them to be able to roll the funds forward also if there is anything that's unused.
Yes, ma'am. All right. With that, if there are any other questions, let's go to Mr. Godfrey. Are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm here.
A pleasure to hear your voice. The floor is yours.
I'm Jared Godfrey, Chair of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and I appreciate the judiciary taking this on. I will say Ms. Pearson covered it pretty well. I'll add a little bit more for perspective and background on this. When a claimant comes to the board, they have to sign a subrogation agreement. So a lot of times through a civil suit, insurance settlement, if you will, also, maybe they were a victim of a DWI, they're going to get money, and we know they're going to get money. It could be 12 months, it could be 15 months. The problem is, you know, they're out of work right now, their bills are accruing right now, their lost income is an issue right now, not 15 months from now. So we're going to go ahead and award them, that which they're entitled to. The awards that we give are tangible, for tangible losses. So we're not just giving them, X amount of dollars. It's a formula correlated to, certain specific losses they've incurred. So that said, the maximum allowable will be $40,000. So say hypothetically we have a victim that comes to us. We give them, $35,000 compensable losses. They come back to us in a year and say, hey, or their attorney, got a settlement, and here's $35,000 back. In essence, we knew we were going to get that money back. And so it was essentially a de facto loan. But we give them that money, with one hand and say, okay, well, hope this gets you by. And when they come to give it back to us, they're not giving it back to us. They're giving it back to the general fund. I will say that generally the money we're funded with doesn't even originate from the general fund, rather right. From the garnished PFDs. Correction gets the biggest portion of that. And then aside from corrections, the Violent Crimes Compensation Board was, I believe back when they originated the system, was the only other recipient. But now OVR gets a portion, and there's other slivers. And because of that, a few years ago with Governor Murkowski's administration, we're facing a decrement, and a substantial decrement at that, a $400,000 decrement. And at that time, we were operating with a budget that was barely over $1 million. And so we had to get funding and increment to some degree from the general fund. The way we look at this is if we were able to take and recoup the money that comes through us to us, but actually goes to the general fund through subrogation agreements, through court ordered restitution, and also other judgments from the court. A lot of times the court doesn't you know, a judge think it's poetic justice for somebody to have to pay the this board who deals with victims of the nature of a crime they committed. And in reality, I think a lot of the judges really realize that the money doesn't come to us. We can't receive it. We have no means to recuperate that without this fund. And so what we're thinking is, you know, in the next era of decrements, this board may be able to entirely take care of itself if it's just given back that which it brings in the last 10 years, that without doing anything whatsoever, the board is brought into the general fund. I have a graph, and when I was down there in June, or in January, it was on the our annual, it was submitted with our annual report, and I know a lot of legislators had a chance to look at it, but I believe it was in the neighborhood of $600,000. And if that was, you know, essentially given to us in a fund, I mean, at one point we were thinking, you know, if that was the principle and we operated that, you know, like an endowment in a matter of years, because we get by on a budget, you know, below $2 million, we could almost, you know, get by for a number of years without even touching the principal that comes back in from this, but rather the interest alone. That was just something that, you know, we'd observe. But nonetheless, if this funding was here and made available for us, that extra 6 cents to a dollar, it's available either way, but if we were able to recuperate that and put it up as state money with this federal matching fund, there's no cap on that that the feds use. And so by bringing that back in, it would be, say, free money, but it would be more money available at no expense to the state of Alaska. And that was essentially the, you know, the thought behind this. And that's why, you know, we thought it'd be a great idea if we could get this done. And it's something we've actually been looking at doing for a number of years, and we really committed to making this year the year that, you know, would happen with the assistance of legislature. So if there's any questions I can answer, feel free.
Pretty thorough testimony, Mr. Godfrey. And Representative Brunberg has a question for you.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Godfrey. The money that comes from the inmates' permanent fund, dividends, does that go into the general fund and then is appropriated to you, or does that in some manner skirt the appropriation process?
Now, you're asking me beyond, you know, a question beyond my personal background. I will say, either way, the appropriation does come from legislature. The allocation is done off of a formula. I don't know who dictates, you know, how what percentage correction gets. I have a pie graph. It wasn't in this year's packet, I don't believe, that I handed out to all the legislators, but I have a packet that shows the pie graph, and it shows corrections piece of that, and they always get the biggest piece. Obviously, they're housing all of the criminals, and they obviously incur the greatest expenses because of these criminals. So I can't say if how you guys go about that, if you know, you have the general fund here and then the garnished criminal PFD into the general fund, and then whatever the dollar amount of that garnished PFD is then redistributed to these entities. I just know that garnished criminal PFD goes exclusively to victims advocacy programs and corrections. Only entities that are in one way, shape, or form in existence because of criminals. And thereby, you know, the concept there being something of a poetic justice, if you will. And Office of Victims' Rights, you know, would also be, that would probably be the least directly tied to criminals. And even that is, theoretically, someone could be a victim, you know, of something that didn't involve a felon and still need that office. But the slice of pie that they're getting from the garnished criminal PFDs is getting bigger since OVR has been in existence, and it's only been around since 2002. But I can't say for sure on that, Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Ms. Pearson could answer my question.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. The funds go back into the general fund and then are allocated out.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Godfrey?
I think next time I'll just defer right to Jane.
Mr. Godfrey, I do that all the time.
Well, you're wise, Mr. Chair.
So is she. Without any questions, is there anybody else here who, thank you very much, Jane. Is there anybody else here to testify in House Bill 414? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. Let's bring the matter back before the committee. Are there any thoughts or suggestions? And Thoughts, suggestions, feelings? Thumbs up from Rep. Samuels, Rep. Dahlstrom, Rep. Gruenberg. Big lip and a nod from Rep. Holmes. And the mature rules chair sits in judgment of us all, rightfully so.
I think Representative Coghill is pondering.
He's two steps ahead of us like he usually is. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask that this committee move House Bill number 414, version 25-LS1418, /C with attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 414 moves from committee. The next.
Yes, I assume this little volume had nothing to do with that bill.
No, it's moving around the table. It's a really great read. It's a great read.
I think it's at my educational level. Help, Mom. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. The next piece of legislation we're going to contemplate during this shortened 90-day session, by way of the initiative process, is House Bill.
I voted for that, Mr. Speaker.
You sponsored it.
John.
Representative Samuels. Is House Bill 355. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing this piece of legislation up. Before I get started to explain my appearance, I told the chairman I wouldn't shave until my bill was heard. So I can shave this afternoon. My name is Representative Kyle Johansson, representing House District 1. And basically, in a nutshell, I introduced this piece of legislation to begin a conversation about the initiative process and the openness and transparency of those who would put their money towards putting an issue on the ballot that ends up as statute. I think my real concern is having legislation, basically what it is legislation that's put on the ballot. And to try and find out and understand who is funding and putting the story out about issues that end up being state law in this body. Everything that we do is disclosed to APOC, all of our income, all of our campaign contributions, all of our investments, etc. And it gives the public a view for them to decide whatever they want to decide, but at least they know the influences or not influences, or however you want to characterize it, of where our money comes from. And we make legislation, obviously, in this building, and I just think it's fair for everybody to understand the financial landscape of any language that's contemplated to end up in the statute books. So, you know, I introduced this to really put it out there and have a conversation. There has been quite a bit of interest across the political spectrum. So I think it's something that's valid to talk about. And basically my intent, and I'm not sure to the letter of the bill that's in front of you we get there, but the intent is to have as much disclosure about the money going into the initiative process as possible. One could theorize or hypothesize that a group from, say, Wyoming would fund a question that ends up on Alaska's ballot that affects Alaskans, and we really are not aware of the full disclosure of where that money is coming from. So I'm not sure if this bill gets there, but it's my intent to have as much openness, disclosure, and immediate access by the public for all of the people who are either pushing to get this question on the ballot or while it's on the ballot. So basically, I lay this before the committee. And this is one of the points I think that's important to have this sort of conversation is, you know, when a question gets on the ballot, at that point, it's basically a public relations battle, in my opinion. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of information or conversation prior to it getting on the ballot. And I know the chairman had sponsored an initiative, and thanks to a constitutional amendment that I worked on as staff, we saw the chairman in Ketchikan. And that really was the first time there was an initiative where there was a presence outside of the major population centers. And I think that was an important step to get everybody into the conversation. When we end up basically finding out about these issues when they're getting to the ballot, conversations like this don't exist. And I think the real value of running statute through this building is such as today, putting an issue in front of a committee and having the discussion about how far you can go, bringing up things that I could never possibly think of. And I don't think that happens in the initiative process. So I lay it out in front of the committee for discussion, and I'm sure there are problems in some people's mind with the bill, but I just lay it out for your discussion. And any specific particular questions about the legislation, Sonia Christensen is sitting to my left, and she's worked extremely hard on this bill. I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but I know to hire competent staff.
We all agree.
So,
hire competent staff.
Yes. But and I open it up to questions. Again, the particulars in the bill, I'm not sure it's going to get us to where we want to go, but I think the conversation needs to take place, and I'd be willing to try and answer any questions.
Thank you. Before I go to Rep. Samuels, I want to say that we've got to just give you a sense of who we have available. Of course, the Department of Law is wants to offer testimony. They're available for questions. We have somebody from ACPIRG, Chris Ellingson from APOC, Chip Toma, Cruise Ship Advocate, is here. And those are the only people that I have so far. Is there one more? I think it's from the last bill.
Okay.
And then I have questions for myself. Rep. Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who right now is allowed to contribute? Is it just free game, corporations, PACs, unions, individuals? Anybody can contribute money either to a organization, which is the front organization, People Against Initiative Ballot Proposition 1, or People For Ballot Proposition 1. Anybody can contribute to that organization right now? Any entity doesn't, there's no restrictions?
I believe that's the case. I'll defer to Sonia.
Sonia Christensen, staff to Representative Johansson. There's no, currently there's no restrictions on who can contribute to initiatives.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I also am not sure if there's any limits on contributions as well from any of these folks that are pretending to impact our statutes.
Representative Johansson, we're friends. I love your community. I had a pleasure going there, and I met with the bill sponsor, who I didn't have the pleasure of serving with, Bill Williams, when I was at the Blueberry Festival in the parking garage, as gritty as it gets, collecting signatures on an ironing board that I had bought at the industrial store because I didn't have a table to set up on, you know, and spent 6 or 7 hours. I mean, and I found that there, as well as in the Southeast Fair, within Representative Thomas's district, and the Delta Fair, and Representative in Speaker Harris's district. In our fair and in Fairbanks, where I was threatened by with litigation, you know, when the signatures were collected by members that used to serve in the legislative body, it was the toughest thing I ever did, and I think it probably greatly dampened my appetite for doing more initiatives. I I think. But I'm also keenly aware of the two pieces of collecting an initiative. I sat next to Representative Croft, who was working on the reserves tax, which failed at the ballot box. And the two pieces that I was so keenly aware of were, one, collecting signatures, and the second half was advocating for or against the issue. I'd like to relay an experience to you. Because it's personal for me in a professional manner. And then you tell me what you would have done, okay? Was in state affairs. Representative Samuel's bill was before the committee to shorten the legislative session to 90 days. I thought, what a great idea. And upon research, I found that it had been introduced 24 times in 15 years. And being a first-year apprentice to the process, not even in my second year, first year, right, looking right for the buzzsaw, I thought, what a great idea to do an initiative on this subject. And went and collected 135 signatures in one day at Pike's Landing during a Sunday brunch. And I came back with a certified check for $100 and sat down with my friend Senator Wagner and said, man, we waste a lot of time down here. And we were at having breakfast at a restaurant that since has closed here in Juneau. And on my way out of town, I dropped it into the Lieutenant Governor's office so that I wouldn't embarrass my colleagues while we were here doing a special session. And I went back to the Republican Friday luncheon that I attend pretty faithfully. I got up and thought, man, I'm going to go collect signatures, and this is such a great issue. People are just going to flock to these booklets. And I wasn't especially well treated by my Republican colleagues, although we live under a big tent. The idea wasn't so popular, to my surprise. And I went back the second Friday, and I thought, surely I didn't communicate my passion for this issue well. And I tried it again and was ridiculed two Fridays in a row. At which point, I called a plumber that I know, and I said, man, I'm aggravated. Let's raise some money. Because the only way that you do these initiatives are collect signatures by paying $1 per signature. Which, for what it's worth, when we had that bill go through state affairs, I told the Lieutenant Governor's office, I said, this is horrible. You shouldn't be able to pay money to collect signatures. And I tried to strike the collection of $1 per signature from, I'm trying to remember what bill that was. Was that an elections bill that we did? First year of the 24th legislative session, I think it was a big elections overhaul bill that we were doing. We were doing the touch screen voting machines, and I thought, this is baloney to even have to pay for a signature. Let's strike that all together. And the institution said, no, you have to leave it in. I don't remember what the rationale was, but it had to do with the constitutional rights and some related issues. And so I found myself having to go out and solicit funds to raise money to get an issue on the ballot, which I was passionate about. Now, in our particular case, we didn't spend any money, and it was only earned media that was the campaign that was out there versus the reserves tax, where millions of dollars were spent on one side of the issue. And, you know, Chip Thoma is going to testify in a little bit. I contributed, you know, hundreds of dollars to defeat the initiative that he sponsored. And I mean, so given all of that, I had some people that contributed to me who are Alaskans, who are dedicated Alaskans, who are so passionate about some issues in this building and have visited and probably registered as a lobbyist under the new rules and visited with everybody at this table about the issues that they're particularly passionate about and would not have risked their position on that specific issue in order to help fund my issue, which they also had great conviction for. And so I find myself feeling a lot of tension on this subject, because I also don't want to see something get hijacked from outside interests. But I, in this case, have unique firsthand experience on the subject. Would you care to comment on my remarks?
Well, you know, Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's any problem with you know, if somebody wants to put their money up to support something that's going to get into the statutes, that's going to affect the entire state of Alaska. I don't think they should have the fear of retribution from other members. I mean, we deal with different issues in this building, many different broadcasts, and people come up and testify in them all the time. You know, if people feel that they don't want to have their name out there because they're afraid in some other arena something's going to happen to them, you know, I don't know. I guess I just don't get it. I mean, if they feel passionate enough about an issue that they're going to write a $100 check to get it out there and change state law, then, you know, I guess I haven't gone through that experience. But, you know, I think if you're going to put your money up to try and change the laws of the state, then I think that ought to be out there. And I don't think that I really... and maybe some people do, but I don't see many of my colleagues treating people that way because they support some other issue. I know I don't. Maybe it does happen. I don't see it. It doesn't happen to me. But I guess one of the main problems that I really have with the whole issue is, and I support the initiative process, definitely. It's in our Constitution. I think it's an avenue for citizens to impact policy when it doesn't get done in this building. And, you know, it really started back in the 1800s with the railroads. If anybody's done any research on initiatives, you know that the initiative process is in most constitutions in the western United States, not very many in the East Coast. And that was really a reaction to when the railroad companies and their influence on politics in the West when they were building the railroads through. You know, in that case, it's very easy to see how the initiative process can't be structured and valued. But if you look at the difference in the initiative process now, it's not even a process. A lot of it is an industry. If you go in and look at the companies and the money and how that has become part of the initiative process, it's a multi-million dollar business now. It's not like it was in the past. It's not simply citizens getting together and saying, you know, we can't get this through the legislature. And the citizens think that it's extremely important to do that. And we need an avenue to get around the politicians because they're not doing what we want. And I think that's fine. But times have changed, and this is an absolute multi-million dollar industry. And it's about money in many cases now. There are companies in the United States that all they do is they do initiatives. That's all they do, and they do it for the money. They could care less about wolf killing, they could care less about cruise ship discharges, they could care less about 90-day sessions. But, you know, it gets down to the money is starting to be the one that is talking. And if that's going to be the case, and I think the citizens have a right to know where that money's coming from. That's so I don't know if that answers your question, but I guess I don't see the problem as you do.
Well, it raises another for me. I mean, your point's well taken, and I share your suspicion of outside interests manipulating our political system 100%. But in this case, I mean, this is only 2 years ago. This would have snuffed out, I mean, it couldn't have been any more homegrown than me peddling around the state. It ruined my summer. And it's been pretty hard on me in the 25th legislature so far, too, I might add. So how do you bifurcate this particular concern? I'm with you. I don't want people hijacking the state of Alaska from without. But what do you do about me? And I can't speak for Chip Thoma's revenue source. I don't know where that came from, but I can speak for mine, which came from in-state, from people that were passionate about an issue, but they're passionate about other issues. They've been observing the legislative process for a long, long time. It's people that have visited our offices and asked for confidentiality in this particular fashion. Anyway, it's not really a question. It was just a response really to your question. Rep. Samuel.
Thank you, and I don't want to beleaguer. If you want to start a debate right now, or
we're headed down that path, just so you know.
I'll ask one rhetorical question, Mr. Chairman. How would you have felt if somebody of the reserves tax, the 90-day session, there was a bear baiting, I can't remember if it was pro or con, there was a cruise ship tax, elect a senator, and aerial hunting on both sides, I think. How would you have felt if somebody had spent millions, and yours would have failed had somebody spent money, after all your work, if somebody had spent millions to kill it, and you don't even know who that was, to kill your thing that you spent your entire summer gathering signatures, and yes, if somebody for an unknown reason, maybe it's an industry, maybe it's a union, maybe it's a PAC of some kind, maybe it's all from California, whatever reason, your idea dies because they had good bumper stickers. I don't know who it was.
Pardon me, because I don't want to get into committee discussion, but my understanding of 355 is that it doesn't deal with that half, that you have to have full disclosure of where the funds come from in that half. This simply deals with the first half, which is the funding for collecting signatures. Am I misunderstanding? I see other people nodding and shaking heads. All I want to do is protect the ability to put something on a ballot. That's the exclusive concern that I have. Once it's on the ballot, then I think there should be full disclosure of where the funds come from for and against. So maybe I'm not haven't read the I've gone over the legislation, and I think I may have a predisposed reading of it. We'll defer to you. We'll defer to Sonia. So introduce yourself for the record and welcome. We're so happy to have you here.
Sonia Christensen, staff to Representative Johansson. House Bill 355 would cover any committee that's formed that spends or incurs $500. So that qualifies any group entity to register with APOC and start financial disclosures.
Sonia, I think the question at the table right now is there a wall between forming the committee to collect the signatures? I mean, we collected 46,000 signatures, so it cost $46,000 and some transportation costs to collect those signatures. Now, if there had been another $1 million spent after that to advocate for or against, my understanding through APOC, and we have somebody from APOC, Chris Ellingson, to answer those questions, my understanding is that $1 million does have to be accounted for and disclosed who the source of that is. Is that correct?
To my knowledge, both of those, the $46,000 that you spoke of and the $1 million, has to be disclosed because the initiative committee as a whole
I'm sorry, we're misunderstanding each other. Okay. Isn't the $1 million, not the 46,000, mm-hmm, but the $1 million, aren't you already required under APOC to disclose the source of those funds under current statute?
Yes, you are.
That's my understanding. So the only thing that we're dealing with are the funds to actually collect the signatures. And that is a multi-million-dollar business for some entities, is kind of your point. Is that right, Representative Johansson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, again, the intent of the legislation, whether it's specifically written that way or interpreted that way at this point, is both before and after that pivot point that you're talking about, before it gets on the ballot and after it gets on the ballot, I want it all disclosed. And APOC can answer, and two other people have their hands up, like first graders in grade school class. But the intent, and again, that's another reason why we're laying this out here in front of the Judiciary Committee, the proper committee to run through and interpret this stuff. The intent is to get both before and after, to get it all out on the table, 100% disclosure. Hence the term the Open and Transparent Initiative Act, otherwise known as OTIA, sir.
Thank you. Representative Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you and I are sort of on the same page here and that I'm trying to get a feel, and I'm wondering if it might be helpful for the committee if we just back up a little bit and ask the bill sponsor to just kind of run us through what exactly this would change, to be sure, because I think there is a little confusion in the committee as to what would be changed by this bill compared to what current law is.
Thank you. And do you have a sectional analysis, or is this something that we should go to APOC for? Do you have a...
I believe a sectional analysis was included in your committee packet.
All right.
Chairman, I would feel more comfortable for APOC, people who know this inside and out, to go through what the specific changes are so I don't miss anything. But, again, the intent is to have every penny, both before and after an issue gets on the ballot, to be disclosed. Because, as I said before, once you get on the ballot, you know, once you've done all the work to get it on the ballot, it's a completely different game. And I think you separated out into two separate things as well. And I want both before it gets on the ballot, people to know who's spending money, and after it gets on the ballot to find out who's pushing yes or no.
Rep. Samuels?
Thank you. And when APOC testifies, I'd like him to address this. My feeling on this is an initiative gets on the ballot, and I agree with the sponsor that all of that should be public, but afterwards an organization is formed, and it's called Alaskans Who Love Small Animals and Children, and then you have $10 million from the Alaskans Who Love Small Animals and Children Fund that buys the ads and the bumper stickers and the TV things. Nobody knows who gives them money. That's what we're trying, that's what the sponsor is trying to get at. Who actually, where'd the money come from for the Alaskans Who Love Small Animals and Children Fund?
And I'm with you. I just don't want to see Jay Ramirez be stymied as a citizen, not as a legislator, because I believe that I did this as a private citizen, but it's been difficult to convince my colleagues. So I want to make sure that will is not stymied. But so maybe here in just a couple minutes we can go to the APOC officer and get real clear on how those two parts of the process are divided and what the disclosure requirements are. Because ultimately, as soon as you're into a 501c6, you know, I don't know how much disclosure there is on any issue and the makeup of those units. I think, you know, swift boats, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, who funded the swift boat group? So the sectional analysis that we have in our packets, do you want to take us through that, or is that something that
I would prefer that APOC did that so they could officially address all the issues that the committee has.
Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor? And if you'll just state, but any other questions? All right, then can we go to Chris Ellingson with APOC, please? Chris?
Good afternoon, Chairman Ramros. This is Chris Ellingson, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And I would be more than happy to answer any of the questions that you might have about how ballot issue groups are addressed under campaign disclosure law.
Thank you, Chris. What documents do you have in front of you? You have the...
I do not have a bill analysis. All I have is the statute, but I can speak fairly comfortably to this issue. Basically, it's interesting. The commission just addressed this reporting question at its commission meeting in Juneau in February. So, I apologize, I did not get any type of an analysis, and maybe we could get that faxed to us so that I can talk about it. But I can pretty much tell you, having reviewed the bill, what areas that it's impacting and what the changes would be.
Well, why don't we have a sectional analysis here. We may have the bill sponsor take us through it, but if you could just speak to the bill and kind of give us a broader framework, maybe that would be a productive place to start.
Okay. Under the Section 4, basically what it's talking about there is changing the current reporting statute, which is where APOC gets the authority to request the reports, and it's taking out the word initiative and just means they're moving it into a new section. So that right now the statute covers initiative, recalls, and referendums because they're all basically the same. Some of them have a few more hoops to jump through to get on the ballot, but they all require people gathering signatures to get them on the ballot. And so therefore they were all treated the same in that particular section. What this bill does is it takes it from one section, just that one little piece, the initiative section, and moves it down into its own section on reporting. And then it requires the reporting be a little bit different than the rest of the law. If you had the whole statute in front of you, you'd see that 110 lays out when reports are required, and it's 30 days and 7 days. And this one is saying that it's going to be the 15th day of each month before the election, and then 2 weeks before the election. So that would be a big change, and it would be something different. The rest of the law, it looks like it's directed at the elections, and staff we don't administer the elections section. But the main thing that we are concerned with is the reporting issues. And currently, when a group or when people want to get something on the ballot, and as Chair Ramros is very familiar with, once they get their first 100 signatures, they're required to register with our office so that people have some idea of this loosely formed organization that's out there doing signature gathering. And that's the first step, and that's the first, you know, that's when people become aware that there's something going on the street.
Chris, may I interrupt you for a moment? It's Chair Ramros.
Yes.
You just used the phrase loosely formed organization.
Yes.
And I believe that is really the issue before us, is that presently it is a loosely formed organization, and House Bill 355 is making an effort to tighten up that definition and require a loosely formed organization to provide fuller disclosure. Is that your impression of this bill? Does it do more than that, or is that the main?
Yes, that is my impression, and it does do more by carving out a particular area for that one issue. However, let me say that generally the people that are registering their first filing, that's what it's called under the statute. It's called first filing. And that first filing is generally the sponsors. It's usually maybe they have to get 100 sponsors to get the first filing. And it's usually the people that have the impetus to get this issue going, and it's usually a handful, like 4 or 5 people. And those are the ones that will come in and register. And quite frequently, sometimes they are represented by attorneys that are working with them to get issues on the ballot.
Okay. Are there questions for Chris with APOC? Chris, will you stand by while we...
Absolutely. I'm here.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's see. Chip, you're here in the room. Do you want to join us up here? Sonia, thank you very much for your presentation. And if you could, while we're going through some more testimony, if you could review the sectional analysis, and then maybe as we're going through this today, we can go back through it so specifically we can understand what each section of the bill does, please. Chip, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for all the drum rolls before my testimony here.
You're Chip Toma, Chris Chip Advocate.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I come before the Judiciary Committee today to give my unqualified support for this bill. I think it's a fantastic thing. It's long overdue. I've been involved personally in three local initiatives and two statewide initiatives over the last 25 years or so. And in every case, the opposition to those initiatives has been overwhelming, and the money has been undocumented. We have no idea where it came from, and I'll speak specifically, since you mentioned it, also to the cruise ship initiative. Mr. Geldhoff, I should also clarify, I'm not a sponsor, I'm not a legal sponsor of the initiative. I'm not a lobbyist, and I'm not compensated in any way for being here. And I have only joined with the initiative group on the cruise ship initiative because I thought it was a good cause, and I worked on the local initiatives here in town to put in a local head tax. So when that process started, Mr. Geldhoff has authorized me, by the way, to tell the committee that, yes, there was one outside contribution of $10,000 from a foundation that came in for the signature gathering part of the operation. So $30,000 was raised total to gather the signatures for the operation, to get the signatures and to get it on the ballot. And most of that work was done by volunteers, but also some people were paid for $1, sometimes $2 for a signature. We had a lot of help locally here in Southeast with the Alaska Native Sisterhood. They considered this to be a very personal issue to them because of subsistence and the use of subsistence foods and the cruise ships plying through the area. That was very instrumental in gathering the signatures here in Southeast, and we, of course, always appreciate the ANS and their support on that. So the total amount that the initiative committee used in total support was $30,000 to gather the signatures and $10,000 total to advertise during the election in August of 2006. And that consisted almost entirely of signs on the buses in Anchorage and also a few radio ads in Anchorage. We did not do any advertising here in Southeast. We didn't need to. Our poll showed us way ahead. And then we found out, much to our dismay, that the other side, and we had no idea who they really were, and we suspected, and we still don't know who they really are, spent over $2 million in fighting this initiative. That was a 50-to-1 advantage that they had over the initiative committee in order to get their word out. I'm sure many of you got the mailers. There were over 27 mailers that were sent out in the mail. Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of millions of dollars worth of TV ads, the mayor of Ketchikan running back and forth and the whole thing. So this $2 million, we found out, of course, came from the Northwest Cruise Association based in Vancouver, Washington, a foreign documented organization. Also, that money that the Northwest Cruise Association gave to PacWest, who are the major group that was doing the advertising, all that money originally came from Miami. Had we known all that, had we had it documented, I think we would have won by 15 points rather than 4 points. I think that's a very, very critical part of the initiative process, is knowing who is not only behind these, but who is fighting these initiatives. So I can wrap up by saying I do have a couple of suggestions for the committee. Number one, I think this bill should apply to municipal ballots. I don't think that there is anything in here of applying to municipal ballots. I think this should apply statewide to municipal ballots. The three initiatives that I worked on here locally, those were all funded. The opposition was all funded by cruise ship firms, again, coming from Miami and Vancouver. We had no idea what those firms, who they were, how much money they were putting in. But we lost one initiative here on the local. We lost two initiatives on the local level. We finally got our local head tax through on the third try. But in all three times, the opposition money was funded from Vancouver and Miami. So that would be my one suggestion. My first suggestion, apply to municipal ballots. Number two, I would prohibit registered lobbyists from contributing to the initiative campaigns. In every case that I've been involved in, lobbyists have been very, very active in these initiative campaigns, and I think that they should be prohibited, as they are, from donating to campaign contributions. That's my second suggestion. And my third is in the last section, which is called Advertising and Promotional Materials. My suggestion would be that we attach a top 10 contributor list to all significant advertising over your choice, $500 or $1,000. So if the group, whoever this group is opposing the initiative in this case or supporting it, if they go to a television, radio, TV station, or a newspaper and put in more than $500 or more than $1,000, a significant portion of advertising, then that list, that top 10 contributor list that went into opposing or supporting the initiative, that should be filed with the advertising. That would be so helpful. That would give the press, that would give the public and everybody a very, very clear look at who the people are that are supporting or opposing this. So those are my basic suggestions. Again, I do support the initiative. I think it'd be very, very helpful to anybody that's involved in this. We do not have a professional signature gathering group. They do in Washington State, this Mr. Tim Iman, who does this. He's loathed by many people. He's supported by many people. We don't have the types, the numbers of people, and the numbers that are required for signatures. We don't have 600,000 signatures required for an initiative. We only have 30,000 or 35,000. As you said, Mr. Chairman, you have to get 45 just to make sure you got enough. But that's a far, far less than the 600,000 they're dealing with in Washington State. And I just don't think that for at least 20 years that we're never going to see a professional group get together and try to do this. There's just no money in it. You have to pay these folks a buck or two to go out and collect these signatures anyway. That really does suck up all the money. One last point. I was contacted by a pollster just about 6 months ago or 8 months ago, and he said to me, would you like to get involved in the fluoride initiative in Juneau? And I said, well, let me think about it. And I went to our Juneau Empire, and I looked up, I just put fluoride in the search thing, and there were 100 letters in my terms that had been written in Juneau over the last 10 years or so on fluoride, almost all in opposition. And I called back this pollster and said, since he was trying to restore fluoride to the water here in Juneau, I said, tell you the truth, I wouldn't get involved with this thing with a 10-foot pole. I don't think any amount of money that you put into this is going to sway this community. And he said, well, thanks for your advice and everything like that. And lo and behold, they went ahead with it, and they got all their money, as we understand it, from the American Dental Association, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it failed 2-1. But we didn't know about the American Dental Association either. You know, supposedly it was local people doing this and everything, but in reality, it was the American Dental Association that was funneling all the money into Juneau to affect our local election, and thank God, in this case, it had failed 2-1. So those are my comments, my anecdotes, Mr. Chairman. Again, I support the bill.
Representative Coghill?
Thank you for coming to testify. The two requirements that this adds that are different reporting mechanisms than any others are the 15th day of each month and 2 weeks before an election. Just as somebody who's had to go through the process, do you think that it would be, first of all, a reasonable reporting requirement? And then, secondly, do you think that it would affect how people campaign for donations? For example, would they change to the 16th of the month to get most of theirs to get the best bang for their buck, you know, type of thing?
I don't think that would have much effect. I think all the advertising has to go in fairly early on these things. So a couple of months in advance is when everything starts. And in my own case, if I just knew who those top 10 contributors were on both sides, whatever date of the month it is, that would be sufficient for me. I don't think we have to, you know, try to narrow it down or game the system so much or think that they're going to game the system. But I think if it's every 2 weeks or so coming up to the election, that's sufficient. But the most recent list of contributors, the cumulative list that happened during that period, the cumulative list, I think ought to be filed with the advertising.
Other questions for Mr. Toma?
Yep, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
For your testimony. We have Steve Cleary with ACPIRG. Mr. Cleary, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me okay?
We can, if you'll introduce yourself and any affiliation that you have and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Cleary. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, ACPIRG. ACPIRG's been operating here in Alaska since 1974. Have about 1,600 members, and our mission is to both protect consumers but advocate for open and honest government here in Alaska. And so I'm here before you today on behalf of ACPIRG and our 1,600 members to express our support for House Bill 355. We want to thank the sponsors of the initiative. We think it'll be a great step for Alaska. As Representative Johansson has stated, ballot initiatives are an important part of the process of making laws here in Alaska, and they are laid forth in the Alaska Constitution. Full disclosure, we believe, is essential to open government, and that includes the ballot initiative process. Alaskans have a right to know who is funding efforts to put initiatives on the ballot. We believe that the current system allows and rewards secrecy by allowing a group to pay signature gatherers and put forth an initiative without having to disclose where their funding is coming from and where their money is going. It is our belief that Alaskans should be able to see who is funding initiatives in the signature gathering phase, not just the phase after an initiative has qualified for the ballot. And I think when Representative Johansson was speaking earlier, it kind of hit me perhaps what he was talking about, but at least the opinion that I have is that once something is on the ballot, it receives some legitimacy. You know, people, Alaskans, would be thinking, well, why is it on the ballot if it hasn't some legitimacy and reason to be there? So I think it's critical that Alaskans know prior to that who's funding signature gathering. For full disclosure, on my part, ACPRG is currently working on the Clean Elections Ballot Initiative. And as part of that, Alaskans for Clean Elections chose to disclose where its money came from for initiative work during the signature gathering phase. In contrast to that is the so-called anti-corruption initiative that is currently in the signature gathering phase, an initiative that would negate the Clean Elections initiative. That initiative group, as all currently don't, does not have to list its contributors nor its expenses while they are in the signature gathering phase. We believe that they are receiving the bulk of their funding from Howard Rich, a New York business tycoon who has funded ballot measures all across the U.S. Measures backed by Mr. Rich have been thrown off the ballot in Montana, where they were under, the group there was using a name similar to what Representative Samuels had alluded to. It was Montanans in Action was the name of the group, but it was funded solely by Mr. Rich from New York. We believe that the source of the money for signature gathering in Alaska is information that should be available to the Alaskan public. The type of secrecy that goes on now is against the spirit of the Alaska Constitution and against the ballot initiative process and open government. We believe Alaskans have a right to know who is soliciting their signature to put a ballot initiative on the Alaska ballot. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Cleary? Representative Samuels?
Thank you. Mr. Cleary, and I just had a thought. In your experience in looking at these things, have there been experiences where a subgroup comes, so instead of, you know, the Alaskans Who Love Children is the main organization, and they're given money then by the Alaskans Who Love Animals, and then that group doesn't, you know, if you want to, you can keep subverting this so you still don't know where the money comes from, either during the collection process or during the advertising process. Have you seen that, or are you aware of that in other states where people try to get out where the money comes from, and you just form layer after layer of group, and you never get to who writes the checks?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, I think that is a good question. I have experienced for 5 to 6 years working on initiatives up here, so I don't know that I'm the best one to answer that. Perhaps somebody from APOC or maybe not even them could tease that out. I don't know what the best way is to peel back those layers of the onion. I guess I personally haven't seen it, you know, in the cruise ship initiative that was mentioned. You know, the Northwest Cruise Ship Association was one of the big contributors, and they didn't try to first give that, as far as I know, first try and give that to another group and then have that group show up on the reporting. And I'm scratching my head right now to think of others, but I'll try to see what I can come up with and ask a few others that question. I could report back to the committee.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Cleary? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. Can we go to Margaret Peyton Walsh, please, the Department of Law?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my only concern regarding this bill is just to alert you to a potential problem that the department believes exists in Section 6 of the bill, in particular the discussion of advertising and promotional material. There's a potential First Amendment concern raised by a United States Supreme Court decision from 1995 called McIntyre versus the Ohio Elections Commission. And in that case, Mrs. McIntyre was a woman who handed out flyers at a school board meetings in opposition to a school board, a bond, I believe. And the the requirement that any such political advertising under this section would include the name of the committee person, group, or non-group entity that was behind it potentially will run afoul of First Amendment protections for anonymous speech that were outlined in McIntyre v. Ohio Elections Commission. And in that case, in particular, the court addressed Ohio's concern for informational interest, which is clearly what is sort of motivating this bill, and found that interest insufficient to justify sort of trumping a person's right to anonymous speech. And so I had some concerns about the constitutionality of this particular part of the bill, absent some attempt to define political advertising. We currently have in other parts of the election statutes definitions, for example, the definition of communication in Section 13, which provides a sort of narrower definition that would exclude the flyers that the Supreme Court found were protected in McIntyre. So that's a sort of narrowing definition of political advertising, I think, is a very advisable thing to think about adding to this bill to try to deal with potential First Amendment issues. And that's sort of the gist of my concern, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on that, or indeed on any other part of the bill if you have them.
So, Margaret, is your concern in Section 6, Line 4, significant contributions? Is there a specific part of Section 6?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it says Section 1545780 that begins on line 25 of that section.
Yes.
So that it adds this advertising and promotional materials and adds a requirement that such political advertising, which is an undefined term, must include the name of the committee, person, group, or non-group entity. It's line 29. And that goes against this sort of idea that there might be a right to anonymity in political speech.
Representative Coghill has a question for you.
Thank you. And was there a threshold question in that? Because I see here we're going to have a $500 limit. And it seems to me that once you start giving a certain amount or become so committed to a particular topic that you're willing to be a part of $500 or more, that it seemed to me then the right to, for the public to know at that point becomes kind of a salient point. So was there a threshold on that court case?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, that's not very clear in the decision. The court does make some sort of reference to the small-scale nature of Mrs. McIntyre's activities, but they don't make a clear distinction, or they don't make that sort of a central part of the analysis that makes her protected. So it's possible that some argument could be made, and it's not clear, I think. I mean, I don't feel comfortable trying to predict how the courts would come out necessarily based on the threshold. My sense is that given the cost of sort of reproducing flyers at Kinko's these days, maybe $500 would be too low a threshold to protect Mrs. McIntyre's activities and to distinguish her from somebody who's spending much more money. But even if the threshold were raised, it's not clear from the court's decision whether they would find that to be a compelling sort of basis for the distinction.
Just to follow up on that. So when I have somebody giving me a contribution of $50 and they're required to put their name and address on an APOC form, could they assert that constitutional right of anonymity?
Through the chair, no. The anonymity is more closely connected to the political speech. So the contribution, the financial contribution, although it can be characterized as a political statement in some ways, is sort of distinguished by the Supreme Court from this sort of political flyer. So if you write out your opposition or your support of an initiative and then sort of pin it up all over the city, that you're making a very explicit, very personal statement of your political view, and it's that sort of very direct expression of the person's political speech that's being protected here with anonymity rather than the financial contribution. So they're going to make a distinction, I think, between sort of spending money and writing out or standing on a street corner, I guess, and, you know, making a personal expression.
And I think with the reporting here, maybe that dollar amount would be something we discussed, but I think we've already determined that people have a right to know. And of course, obviously, we've determined some right to anonymity on your freedom of speech, but I would be reluctant to say that at $500 they retain their anonymity. So,
Representative Holmes, Samuels, and Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On a follow-up to that, I was wondering if you had, Margaret, if you had a citation for that Supreme Court case you're referring to.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, the citation is 514 U.S. 334, and then it's a 1995 case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the Department of Law. On my ads that I do when I campaign for myself, I always have to have a paid for by. So it's not the collection that goes out, but the expenditures of the money going out. I paid for by, you know, Ralph Samuels for State House or whatever. Is there going to be a difference then between the anonymity where a group could come out and say Ralph Samuels is a good guy or not a good guy or whatever?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, that's an interesting question. The Supreme Court hasn't actually addressed the sort of paid for by a particular candidate committee, and they make a distinction also between elections for office versus ballot initiatives or bond initiatives or bond sort of things. So that McIntyre was concerned with not with the election of an individual, but with an issue election, and so there's some distinction there. But it's not at all clear whether the paid for, I mean, the extent to which that anonymity protection would expand if the Supreme Court were actually to be faced by this question. And I don't know. I don't know where they would come out, to be honest. It seems to me it's not absolutely clear that the paid for by is not protected by this anonymity issue. There are three different opinions in McIntyre: majority opinion, concurring opinions, and in a dissent. So there's a lot of difference of view on the Supreme Court about this. But the specific question that you're asking hasn't come to them yet, and I just don't know what to say in terms of how that would be affected. I do think one solution with this bill would be to provide a definition of political advertising that narrows a little bit to exclude or to protect that which we already know from Supreme Court jurisprudence they would protect, and that leaves open activities that they haven't yet said should be protected. I don't know if that was very clear. But the current definition of communication that we have in AS 15-13090 essentially provides a protection for the Mrs. McIntyre type of speech, but not for many other things. And that seems to me to be one way to go with defining political advertising. So that we can be sure that an Alaskan citizen who wanted to print up flyers and spread them around town anonymously could do that because McIntyre tells us that they should be allowed to, but that most other things would not be covered.
Thank you very much. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a separate, if other people want to follow up on this, it's not a separate topic.
All right. Representative Lynn?
I do. Representative Sam, we'll get a chance here.
Yes.
This is very interesting, and my colleagues here stole some of my question, actually, because I had, about the same thing, because, the basic question is, why can somebody have anonymity going for initiative, but not anonymity giving me money for my campaign? Many of us are elected because we stand a certain way on particular issues. We know it's personality, we know it's all these other things, but it also, most of us stand strong on particular issues. And so I think my election, I suspect some of the other elections, have been because of our position on issues. So we do on issue campaigns, most of us do. And we have some other states, as I understand it here. What about these constitutional problems been addressed in other states for that have a similar bill as proposed by HB 355?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, are you asking me, have other states tried to pass similar bills and succeeded or failed? Is that your question?
Well, partly, but if they in fact passed such a bill, were there constitutional challenges in those states on the matters that you raised?
Well, I mean, Representative Lynn, through the chair, that McIntyre is essentially the sort of the preeminent case on this issue, where Ohio had passed a statute forbidding anonymous political leafleting, communications, advertising. And Mrs. McIntyre was fined under that statute, and her case went to the Supreme Court, and they ruled that it was unconstitutional. Various other states have other sorts of, I mean, the paid-for-by requirement that we have here is also found in many, many other states, and you'll see it, I think, even at the federal level, that this is a very, very standard sort of position. And so one might infer into it that's going to be okay, but that there's a huge gray area between what Mrs. McIntyre is doing and what in the sort of paid for by a presidential candidate or even a candidate for state office. The only case that's actually gone all the way is McIntyre. So it's our sort of baseline for, it's really the only clue that we have about what's going to happen to anonymous speech when that issue comes to the Supreme Court, which is one of the reasons why I'm not really able to tell you with any certainty whether something is going to be, quote-unquote, constitutional or not, because we don't have a lot of information.
I suppose that's true on a number of different issues, but I just have a hard time struggling, as my colleague Reverend Cogger frequently says, I'm struggling to understand why somebody gives me a contribution, whatever amount, that's not anonymous and must be reported, yet for an initiative, it is anonymous, and if it's not anonymous, it could be challenged by the Supreme Court. So I'm just struggling with that. Maybe as we proceed through the hearing, I'll better understand it.
I think, Representative Lynn, that's a question that we're not going to pose right now. We're going to give Chris a little bit of time to ponder that. I'd like to go to the sponsor and then back to Representative Holmes. And Chris Ellingson, if you can perhaps just take a few minutes to provide for us where that provision came from that seems so separate from individual candidates, this ability to have anonymity for the portion of this process which concerns me the most, which is the ability to collect signatures to seed a ballot or seed an initiative onto a ballot. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I have a 2:30 with my senator, and I'm going to step out of the room for a few moments. Sonia, if it gets to the committee time, is more than capable of running through the sectional analysis for Representative Holmes. If I don't make it back, or if you move on to the next bill, I hope I've given everybody something to chew on and to think about, because I really think this is an important issue, and Representative Lynn's questions about contributions are part of the real problems that I have with the way the system is. So, again, I apologize for stepping out, but Sonia can more than handle any questions that you have, and I'll try to make it back as soon as I can.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. Not entirely sure whether they're better aimed at Department of Law or at APOC. Would you like me to go ahead and fire away?
Fire the question and see where it goes.
Okay. One of my questions is, in looking at Section 5 of this bill, trying to figure out how we would handle, if you have a group that raises money for several different purposes. So you've got a sort of a group that, say, represents a certain, I'm thinking of things like ATIA or the Alliance or other groups that sort of represent a number of people. If a group like that were to contribute more than $500 in a calendar year, does the group name go down, or do you have to dig down into their membership or who it is that contributed to them? How far does this go?
I'm not sure that's a question for bill sponsors. Sonia, I think you should come up here and join us. I'm not sure. Chris, can you answer that question?
Certainly, Chair Ramros. Ballot issues just report where the money comes from. So if a using Representative Holmes' example, ATIA, the Travel Association, if they wanted to support a bill to have people flown in, that's going to be an initiative, a ballot question, then it would come most likely out of their general funds. I think the issue that of the anonymity is that under the disclosure law, a group is triggered when they solicit money from individuals. So, for instance, the ballot group would be one group, and they're out there soliciting money from this association. The association doesn't necessarily solicit money from their members to be specifically used for that ballot question. Sometimes it comes from member fees. Sometimes it comes from ways people just want to support something. I hope that answers your question through the chair to Representative Holmes.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up, I think so. I just want to try to get this as clear as I can in my head. So, in other words, if one of these groups were simply making a donation to another entity, say you got the, what was our group for small, Alaskans for small small animals and children, if a group were just giving a contribution from money that was just generally held in their general fund, then the only reporting that would happen would be that that group gave the money. What about if that group were to go out and specifically solicit, then would they be under their own separate reporting requirements and would have?
Absolutely. They would be formed a group and they would have to name themselves. Generally, it would be, you know, Citizens to Support Small Children and Little Animals.
Okay. So that brought up another question with a different section of the bill, which requires that the title of the initiative be in there and the word for or against, which I have a couple of problems with that section. But one of the problems that hadn't even occurred to me is, do we now have six different groups that are titled Citizens for Alaskans for Small? I mean, are we now requiring that all those groups that are formed, if more than one group is formed for or against, that they all have to have the same name?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, no, they don't. And let me, I can relate a real-life instance where we had an outside entity try to tie up every conceivable variation on a name so that nobody else could use it. Most people that are supporting or opposing ballot issues will come up with their own name. Sometimes it's an acronym. Sometimes it'll be just plain flat out, you know, Citizens for or against. Does that answer the question?
Maybe. I'm looking now at this. It's Article 4. It's on page 3, lines 9 and 10, is the new requirement that everything, that all such groups, and I guess I have a number of questions, Mr. Chairman, if you'll let me kind of play this out.
Sure.
One of them is I can't find a definition of initiative committee anywhere in the bill or in the statute. Is there a definition of initiative committee anywhere?
Through the chair, no, Representative Holmes. They are considered a group under the statute. If you look at the definition of what a group is.
Okay. So they just fall under group, so there's no need for a
statute. Yeah, and it would be under B.
Okay.
And it's 400.
Okay. That's fine. I just wanted to make sure that I knew what we were talking about. So now, looking at page 3, lines 9 and 10, you have an initiative committee, and all initiative committees have to use the actual full title of the initiative and the words for or against. So you could have, say, two or three different initiative committees either for, I mean, theoretically, I guess you'd have one group opposing and one group for it. Do you ever see multiple groups formed either to support or to oppose a ballot initiative?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Holm, we have. I will point out, though, that this particular section, 1545-760, is not ours to administer. It's under the Division of Elections. Okay. There are parts of this bill that probably should maybe be under campaign disclosure, but this is something that we would not have any administration over.
Okay. All right. I guess I just have some concerns about the fact that we're hearing that more than one. I have problems with this section for two reasons, so I guess I'll just state them. The first is I'm afraid that if you've got two or more groups either in favor of or opposing, this kind of leads them to end up with the same name because they have to have the full name of the ballot initiative and the words for or against. So that gives you some pretty limited options for your name. Second problem I have is sometimes the names of a ballot initiative are fairly leading one way or the other. And if you are opposing it, you may also take serious exception. I guess an example was given earlier by APOC that there's an out there that's being called the anti-corruption. Well, the people who are against it would have to be citizens against anti-corruption. I think they would have
citizens for corruption.
or citizens for corruption, I guess they could. But it sort of forces a group that's opposing to take the characterization given by the group that is for the initiative. And if you're opposing it, you probably don't want to have to use the characterization that was given by the other side. So I guess those are some concerns
in fact,
I have
the
with
example,
this.
Representative Cogdell. The example she used fits on both sides of that question.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, against clean elections.
Yeah.
Exactly. It just, you know, it doesn't really lend itself to a good debate.
Yes. So. For now, I'm just content to put that out there, and we can. My concerns with section one of this little subsection one.
And I have a question. Representative Grunberg.
Ms. Ellington, my staff will contact you to follow up on your comments about who should administer this. I see we have an amendment in the packet to do that in one area, but I'd like you to be thinking where your staff would recommend that we clarify maybe what APOC should administer in this. So I'm just alerting you, and you can be thinking about that. I don't need an answer on the record.
For the chair, thank you, Representative Grunberg.
And Ramirez, Chris, do you know institutionally where it came from that that you don't have to disclose, that these loosely formed organizations or groups do not have to disclose where their seed money comes from to put an initiative on the ballot?
Thank you, Chair Ramirez. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I know this one chapter and verse. It was a commission decision that arose out of some court cases that were applied to candidates, and it was carried through to ballot issues, and I believe that at the time and up through 1997, that the language in the statute said that the activities were intended to influence the outcome of the elections. And if there is not a question on the ballot, there could be the argument made that there's no election. And so the commission and this was based on a lot of discussion, and I went all the way back to the minutes from 1982, and I know that there was a lot of discussion regarding whether it was constitutional that they could ask for this if there was, like, for instance, they could be out gathering signatures and not get enough signatures to get it on the ballot, so there isn't going to be an election.
So why should there be a disclosure if it never makes it to the ballot procedure? Because many of these, did the gambling one, did it fail to meet the initial timeline within 12 months? I know there have been a variety of issues that didn't make it before the gavel went down in January. They may have made it within their 12-month period that's available. From the time that you're certified, you have 12 months to collect the signatures and turn them in. But if you fail to turn them in before the gavel goes down for the upcoming legislative session, then you miss that election cycle. So if you would have, like the clean elections, they failed to collect enough signatures before January 15th, but they probably still have 5 or 6 more months to collect signatures and turn them into the Division of Elections, but they will miss both the August and November of 08 election cycles, but they would be available in the August of 2010 election cycle. But right now, they're nothing. They're a loosely formed organization. Is that a pretty good reading of this?
Through the yes, Chair Ramros, it is. One thing that I would like to mention and point out is that there are some groups that will voluntarily disclose their signature gathering funds. And it's happened twice, well, three times that I know of. And you're right, when you said the gaming issue, they did not make it, but they did do disclosure, and that was basically because they were issuing advertising, trying to advocate for people to vote for when it gets on the ballot. So because they made that one step to vote for, then they went into the reporting requirement, and they didn't have a problem disclosing.
So for the benefit of the committee, because I'm pretty familiar with a lot of these, if you quietly go about collecting signatures, then you don't have to disclose anything. But if you begin to advertise that you're collecting signatures, then you would have to disclose. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, Chair Ramros, is that if you are saying that I'm collecting signatures and when this gets on the ballot, I want you to vote for it.
Right, because then you're trying to influence the outcome of an election.
That may or may not get there. Yes, that is correct.
Representative Grunberg?
When we finish with Ms. Ellingson, I have a question for Ms. Peyton Wall.
And I have in line, too.
I'm sorry, Representative Lynn?
Well,
for whom is your question?
Well, I guess the lady who's speaking to us or anybody else. I know that, as I understood it, you were saying that if you fail to get enough signatures, so it never makes it to the election, so ergo you don't have the election, then why are you making these people contributed accountable or reveal their names? Is that correct? Could it not happen to one of us where we file for election to somebody, we get a certain number of contributions reported to APOC, then we withdraw before the election?
True.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, a group that is in the signature gathering stages would not have to do any disclosing because there would, if it didn't get to the ballot, because there would not be an election. There are different standards of reporting for candidates versus groups that are formed to support or oppose ballot issues, and candidates are held to a higher standard. And you are correct, if you were to run for office and then withdraw, you would still have to show how you distributed your money.
And that just seems inconsistent.
See, and Representative Lynn, I'm not sure if it's inconsistent, because if I'm a registered voter living in District 10, the moment that I file to run for District 10, I'm fully in the race. And then if I opt to pull out, then I'm fully out of the race. And there are laws that govern your signatures. Once they're in and they're certified, you actually, the prime sponsors actually lose custodianship of the initiative, and the custodianship transfers over to the state of Alaska. So in that case, once the signature, if you've collected 30,000 signatures, you have more than enough signatures, but you decide, I don't want to put this, well, it almost happened with the Clean Water Initiatives. There was a deal cooking between the administration and between Renewable Resources, and at the last minute, Renewable Resources says, we don't want the deal, we want to turn these signatures in and get them certified, and they're in the process of certifying the signatures right now on the Clean Water Initiatives, which I oppose.
If I may.
Representative Lynn.
The original question I was going to ask when I was in line here, and I think I know the answer to this, but for the benefit of anybody who's listening and watching on gavel to gavel, there's a concern out there that let's take, for example, you know, making a contribution to one of these initiatives or whatever. Let's say you've got Planned Parenthood on one hand, and you've got Alaska Right to Life on the other hand, organizations diametrically opposed to each other in their goals. If they have to list all of their contributors who then contribute to this initiative, you have, in effect, a database of all the membership of these two diametrically opposed organizations. Nobody meant that, did they? I want to make sure that we understand that was not part of what we're talking about here. I don't think it is.
It is not.
But am I correct?
Chris?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, let me restate what I think you're asking. You're asking if there were a ballot issue and these two groups wanted to participate in the ballot issue, would all of their membership or all of their contributors have to be disclosed? Is that correct?
Basically, because they get their money, both these groups, I believe, get, well, some of their money at least comes from contributions.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, that would not... how do I say this? There are currently groups registered for those entities, and their main purpose is to support candidates. So therefore, they would be unable to participate with ballot. Well, they could give $1,000 to ballot issue groups. If they wanted to form a separate arm of their organization and solicit funds for whatever the issue is that's going to be voted on, they could do that. For ballot issues. In fact, we do have some groups that are candidate support, and then that same group is called, it's got the same name, but it says ballot initiative. We have about four of those. So that does not, that's not outside the realm of possibility, but what you're asking, I believe, is would their core contributors be disclosed as a ballot issue? No, they would not, because they would have to form a separate entity. Does that answer your question?
Partially, I know that one of the groups that I belong to, there's an educational group, and then there's the political group. And so a political group do contribute to candidates, and I guess could contribute to initiatives if they chose to do so.
Through the chair, Representative Lim, that is correct, but they, as far as the list of who contributes to that group, it's already on record.
Thank you.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. And a question for Chris, and I guess for the bill sponsor is, by not disclosing, then you, just like the question that I asked Mr. Cleary from ACPIRG, is you simply to form two organizations then. You have one is Alaskans Against Ballot Measure Number 3, and the secondary organization is just, you know, Citizens for Better Government, and everybody contributes to Citizens for Better Government, who then contributes to Alaskans Against Ballot Measure Number 3, and you still don't know where the money came from.
I mean, through the chair, Representative Samuels, you would, if you went back and looked at the secondary group, you could see where the money came from. Ballot issues enjoy... the ability of being able to collect as much money as they want from any source that they want. And I think that comes from a constitutional thing of free speech. I'm not sure because I'm not an attorney. I just know that ballot issues are generally something that people are able to contribute to in any amount from any place. Just the same, on the same token, anybody can make independent expenditures supporting or opposing those issues in any amount from any source. So what you have, I believe, is a speech issue, although I don't know, and probably Mags can speak to that better than I can.
Chris, can I interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
Yeah, and I want to get back to my point. Is the whole point of the legislation is that any money, and to me, from the minute you collect a dollar to get your first signature, and whether it makes the ballot or doesn't make the ballot is irrelevant. If you're collecting money to influence public policy in Alaska, we should know where the money came from. But if you go back to the Tongass Conservation Society, Jaws is here in the audience, if they can contribute $1 million to ballot measure number 1 and we don't know who gave them money, then we haven't gotten to the goal. And the goal is to have a transparent process. We know who's trying to influence public policy in the state of Alaska, whether it be the Sierra Club or ExxonMobil or, you know, I'm sitting here curious. Who wanted to shorten the session that was willing to give money? I mean, I sponsored a bill, but, you know, it, so... How do we get to the goal? I thought that the bill did it, but if you go down, if we don't allow the second layer to come in, then, I mean, I've never done this in my life, and I've thought of a way around the whole bill in 15 seconds with the second organization.
Is that true, Chris?
Through the chair, there is disclosure. It is an, when people make their contributions, the disclosure comes from that organization so that people are aware of who is, what organization is supporting or opposing an issue. For instance, there are several entities that favor one side of an issue that might not even be in the state of Alaska, but because it isn't a ballot issue, they are able to contribute, so they pony up all their money, but it has to be disclosed to the group that they contribute or as an independent expenditure. So the public has is given the right to know who these contributors are. They know that it's a big company. They know that it's an individual. So I don't know if that answers your question, Representative Samuels, but there is a disclosure. On ballot issues, you're going to get, for instance, one that just comes to mind, and this may be a poor example, but several years ago, there was an issue on the ballot that addressed same-sex marriages, and one of the major contributors was the Mormon Church out of Utah. Now, they reported that they contributed, you know, $150,000 to one of the groups, but we don't know who made that $150,000 up because they're not required to give us that information.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
This is a question for Ms. Peyton Wall. Are you still on the line, ma'am?
Yes, Representative Grunberg to the chair. I'm still here.
Okay. Now, I vaguely recall the McIntyre case. That is the case that said there's a right of anonymous free speech in political situations in certain cases. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Suppose it, and this is just a general question, you may or may not be able to answer it. Suppose the legislature cannot control the right of a group, in this case, an entity, to make anonymous contributions. Do we have the right to state in election material that the group that favored the process, the proposition or opposed it, refused to reveal who they were? Could we put that in the election pamphlet and stuff, that this group refused to divulge who they really were?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, let me paraphrase your question back to you to be sure I understand exactly what you're asking. If we were to have a group, Alaskans who love animals and small children, and they were providing, they were making a contribution to a pro-initiative group, or are they the initiative group that you're imagining?
I don't care. The question is, if they're exercising their constitutional right, if there is one, I'm assuming for the purpose of my question that there would be one that would apply, and we wouldn't have a right to force them to divulge, could we then say, if you do refuse to divulge, can we reveal that right in the election material? So we say, this group, that the ballot proposition was supported by the ABC group who refused to divulge who they really were and where they were from. Could we put that in there? Is that constitutional?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I'm pausing to desperately to try to think if I can even begin to answer that question.
I don't need an answer now. If you could think of that and respond in writing, I don't want to put you on the spot.
I would be delighted to respond in writing to you, sir. I think there is a distinction to be made, though, possibly that might help get us towards an answer, which is that the protection for anonymous speech comes for a published statement of a political position on a ballot measure that you then you wouldn't have to sign. So if I wanted to write an advertisement to appear in the ADN or that I'm going to hand out on a street corner that was against ballot measure 3, whatever it is, that I'm not obligated to sign that. But if I'm spending money, the other disclosure requirements that we're talking about, where contributions come from, where money is spent, that's not protected in the same way. What we're really just talking about with McIntyre is just whether you have to sign the flyer that you're handing out.
I see. So we're really, through the chair, talking about probably the language in Section 780 on page 3.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Grimwick, my concern in terms of the anonymous political speech is solely confined to Section 45780, or I mean that part of Section 6 that creates this new requirement.
Okay.
And I don't think that it extends to the disclosure, to the reporting requirements, which have been treated differently by the courts.
Okay, then I would just finalize my question then, lasering it down to Section 780. If, in fact, McIntyre might prohibit us from requiring the language on line 29, must include the name of the committee, person, group, or non-group entity, if that were a constitutional protection, we could simply add the phrase, or the fact that the author of the advertising refused to reveal the source. That is my question, and if you feel you can answer it, please do. If not, if you could respond to the committee in writing and the staff could then distribute it.
Representative Grimberg, through the chair, so you're imagining a requirement that a political advertiser, let's say the ADN has a full-page ad, that you're going to require either that somebody list their name or that there be a statement that the supporter of the advertiser who's paid for this announcement has refused to reveal his identity?
Yeah, that's the question, if in fact the McIntyre case applies.
Let me, if I may, take you up on the offer to get back to you in writing on that issue. I want to do a little bit of checking before I say whether I think that would be permitted.
Yeah, I'd like that as soon as we can, so we can offer the amendment at the appropriate time. Yeah,
and Chris, before Rep. Samuels asks a question, I appreciate that you think that you're calling in on Section 780, but because my interest is in the is very specific, and that is the signature gathering portion.
Yes.
You have suggested, after arduous research back to 1982 and researching the minutes, that the genesis of that came from a position that the commission took after a great deal of discussion. I want to know whether APOC supports these changes to that 355 make to that portion of the initiative process.
Thank you, Chair Ramroth. The commission actually, if you look at the pure reading of 1513.110 little e, it says that the first report will be within 30 days after the first filing, and then a report is due quarterly thereafter. So the law envisions currently that they do already do these reports, that they disclose quarterly up until their first regular report is due. I can read you specifically the statute's citation, and this is what I was saying when I first started talking, was that the commission revisited this whole issue at the last meeting and have instructed staff to start requiring these reports and making sure that they do have this information. And basically, little e says that a group formed to sponsor an initiative, a referendum, or a recall shall report 30 days after its first filing with the lieutenant governor. Thereafter, each group shall report within 10 days after the end of each calendar quarter on the contributions received and expenditures made during the preceding calendar quarter until reports are due under A of this section. And in my research, I could not find the history on that particular section was that this did not come into being until early 80s. When the statute was first drafted back in 74, there was no provision for any group reporting. And this was where the commission's, somebody introduced legislation to get the groups in there. So now there's group reporting, and then it got honed down to ballot issue groups and referendum and recalls.
and there is that one report section where it is a requirement, but because of what the previous commission decision and advice from the then Attorney General's office, staff has not ever required the disclosure during the signature gathering unless they are advocating for or against when it gets on the ballot.
Yes, ma'am. That's what I was going to say, is that our reports were zero because we were not advocating. We were only spending money for gathering signatures. So we were allowed to. We did fill out a report, but it was a zero. It was a zero report, which were the APOC rules.
Instructions.
Because we weren't advocating for a position. We were just raising money for the purpose of collecting signatures. Representative Samuel has a question.
Thank you. I've got a question for the Department of Law, Mr. Chairman. The constitutionality, what if we changed the bill and we said there will be no groups at all? The same as I mean, no PACs, no companies. You know, I don't want Right to Life or Planned Parenthood or the Sierra Club or ExxonMobil, or nobody can contribute except individuals, and you don't limit the amount of money. Just any individual that wants to give, it's full disclosure. You can't hide behind the skirts of a corporation or a nonprofit or an industry group or environmental group. You just 100% disclosure, no limit on the amount of money. And if you want to give money to the Right to Life or Planned Parenthood wants their membership to give money, they should encourage them to give money as individuals. But there will be no PACs. Is that constitutional or not?
Chris, before you answer that, let me just...
Excuse me, through the chair, that's directed to the Department of Law.
Oh, I'm sorry. But before you answer that, Representative Samuels, the Fairbanks North Star Borough has just allocated $150,000 to do a ballot initiative to raise the property tax exemption. And so in your manner of thinking, every property taxpayer in the Fairbanks North Star Borough would be on that list because of the fractional funding that those people would...
My way of thinking, the Fairbanks North Star Borough could not contribute. Individuals, and this I disagree with Mr. Toma on the municipality. Let municipalities handle their own laws. Right. But on a statewide initiative, if you want to collect money, you can. Initiative. And if Mr. Jones wants to contribute $10 million, Mr. Jones contributes $10 million. It is public. It's immediate. And there are no companies. There are no environmental groups. There are no... anything. It's instant reporting, but individuals only.
So that would preclude the Fairbanks North Star Borough from doing precisely what they're doing right now, which is the full funding of a ballot initiative, right, from nothing to through the collection phase and then presumably to the advertising phase, because then...
Is it a statewide ballot?
Statewide ballot.
Yes, it would preclude them from doing so.
And let's get the Department of Law to weigh in on Rep. Samuel's question that I interrupted.
And the bill sponsor, perhaps.
You're doing such a great job.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, the First Amendment concern regarding anonymous speech is not implicated by the hypothetical that you're raising. So the rules about disclosure or the anonymous, you're not allowed to make an anonymous campaign contribution. If you're an individual, you can't make, you have to declare your name. And so it's not clear, I don't believe that there would be a constitutional problem with trying to exclude groups and corporations and any other sort of way of trying to hide where the money was coming from. I don't believe that that would raise a constitutional problem, but I have not researched that question. And so I don't feel particularly comfortable in making any sort of guarantee to you. Off the top of my head, I think that that would be constitutional. But as I say, I didn't research that particular issue. And so, again, I'd appreciate an opportunity to have a look at that and come back to you with a more researched and informed judgment on that question.
All right, you've got it. We're going to take a final question from Representative Gruenberg, and then we're going to give Sonia just a few of the pointers that we have and try and conclude this in the next 5 minutes or so. Representative Gruenberg?
Yes. Ms. Payton-Wall, I'd like you to also look particularly at Article 11 of the state constitution on the initiative provisions and the constitutional decisions that have been rendered by our Supreme Court, which has interpreted those provisions very broadly. Look at those in conjunction with the fundamental right of association, that do those provisions, and this question for me, do those provisions not imply that people can associate for the purpose of either supporting or opposing a ballot proposition? And what the Representative Samuels was talking about was banning them entirely, not simply requiring the disclosure of the people involved. I think there, personally, there'd be severe problems if we were to ban the right of association given the broad reading of Article 11 by the state Supreme Court.
Representative Gerber, through the chair, I will look at that. Perhaps I understood Representative Samuels' hypothetical slightly differently from you. My understanding was he was not talking about preventing organizations from forming in support of or against ballot initiatives, but that another kind of an organization could not contribute money to a ballot initiative committee in order to hide the original source of the money, so that Alaskans who love women, who love animals and children, couldn't make a contribution to a ballot initiative committee. The members of the Alaskans who love animals and children would have to make individual contributions to the ballot committee in order to help fund whatever the ballot was, presumably something good about animals and children.
I don't think any group is going to say we're banding together to hide. I think they're going to say we're banding together by our right of association. Thank you.
Okay. Point made. So, Sonia, if we just go around the table here and give you the macro concerns that members have, you're clear on what my concern is, and I don't know whether we can reconcile that or not. I may get rolled in my own committee, and that's, you know, Representative Samuels and Chip Thoma and Eckberg can all just gang up on my rights, and I probably will withstand it. What are some of the other concerns for your benefit so that we have an opportunity to have this bill?
I want to look at, first of all, I want to look at that McIntyre case and these other cases, but I've honed in on two things.
Okay.
Number one was what Ms. Ellingson said about who should administer the various parts of this. I tend to think, my gut feeling is that Public Offices Commission is probably well suited to administer a lot of this. And secondly, the question that I was talking to Ms. Peyton Wall about concerning Section 780 and whether, number one, the McIntyre case does apply, and secondly, if so, could we add a provision that says if you're going to be anonymous, that fact shall be disclosed on all your ads that you've refused to identify yourself?
Gentlemen, ladies.
Mr. Chairman, I have my concern that on page 3, lines 9 and 10, about the naming of the groups was an ongoing concern of mine.
Before or against?
Before or against, okay. Exactly.
Rep. Samuel?
Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cargo?
Two things that I would probably look at. The findings and the intent. If we state it statutorily, I don't know that we need the findings and intent. And then secondly, the ratio of reporting that is new in Section 5, you should probably bring to the committee what other reporting requirements under APOC, other filing issues. We're creating a new one, and I just want to make sure what our whole schedule looks like.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other final thoughts?
Rep.
Samuels, do you have a concern about the large groups, or?
I think I've made my concerns known.
I think you have. All right. Representative
Lynn? I'll get a turn, too. First of all, I strongly support the concept of the bill, the open and transparent initiative. And I would like to see somehow the contributions for initiatives be aligned insofar as possible and practical and constitutional with the reports that we as candidates have to make, because the principle is exactly the same. Who's contributing to cause, whether the cause for the small animals and children, or the cause for one of our re-elections, or what? It needs to be transparent. And I like to see that aligned insofar as possible. And, corporations can't contribute to my campaign, then why should they be able to contribute to an initiative campaign? Lobbyists can't contribute to me, why should they be able to contribute to an initiative campaign? So I'd like to see them aligned as far as possible.
Okay. Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I've got one other comment. I had two amendments on here, both of which didn't bode favorably with the drafter of the amendments. And I'm not a lawyer, and I hate to play one on TV, but generally speaking, the Supreme Court has found that it is far different to contribute to individuals than it is to contribute to ideas. And that's the problem. I think that Amendment number 2, which I'll offer at the appropriate time, is perfectly fine. Amendment 3 will be an interesting debate. And
okay. Representative.
This bill didn't go to State Affairs, and I'm glad that we're taking the time we need in this committee to really look at some of this stuff. This is an extremely important bill with some very important constitutional issues, and I appreciate the way you're running this, Mr. Chair, to allow this to be done.
Thank you. 10 minutes after 3, we're adjourned.